So I'm indebted to Aristotle for helping me, you know, both invoke ancient authority and also synthesize something that I've more or less understood my whole life, and that is the importance of balance. And so in Aristotle, this comes out of his work on ethics, one of his works on ethics, and he talks about how the right thing to do, the virtuous thing, is always the middle road between two extremes. So for instance, if you want to be courageous, on one side is cowardice, right? Being afraid, run away, little crybaby. On the other side, which we may not think a whole lot about, is being rash, being stupidly courageous. Like, that isn't actually courage, that's dumb. The guy who just jumps in both feet and then begins to ask questions after the fact. And Aristotle says courage is somewhere in between these two extremes. The reason I think about that is it's a lot like preaching, especially on passages like this. You need courage. Yeah, that's part of the point. No, I'm kidding. It's not the point. The point is that this is a radical passage from Jesus. And the question is, do you kind of lean out? Oh, so sorry. Let me complete the thought with Aristotle. I'm sorry. So Aristotle says we have a tendency on one or the other. You need to know yourself. You're either by nature a coward or by nature rash, foolhardy. And if you want to end up in the middle, you need to lean way out to the other side. So if you're a coward, try to act rashly or foolhardily, and you might end up in the middle. Don't say to yourself, oh, I need to aim for the middle, because your tendency towards cowardice is going to pull you way over that side. So here's the thing. Very few people in 21st century Canadian culture, Anglican church, are going to immediately run out and do these crazy things that Jesus is telling us to do. It's just not a temptation for us, most of us. And to point the extreme, because this isn't as extreme as some of the things that Jesus says, there was a time in which people, like St. Francis of Assisi, heard the gospel, go sell everything you have, and come and follow me, and he did that. There have been people who have, I don't know if they've ever chopped off their hands, but another thing that Jesus says is if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. If your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. And there was a time in which a preacher would have to say, okay, folks, he's speaking metaphorically here. I want to see both hands when you come back to church next week. Don't go crazy here. That's not a danger in our culture. Right? I don't think the preacher needs to warn you about not chopping off your hands, because we'd all be handless by this time if that were a temptation, right? So the tendency, the temptation is to think we're already mostly as a culture leaning over on this side that wants to sort of soften what Jesus has to say, to kind of take the sandpaper out, get rid of the rough edges, to make the cross nice and smooth and gold gilt. So yes, Lord, I'll pick up my cross and follow you. By the way, do you notice the diamonds? You know, that's our culture, our tendency. So the temptation is for the preacher to want to say, well, okay, my temptation is to say, we really need to lean hard over towards this radical side. But I do think that might miss the picture, because the other thing, is that we are called not to be children in our understanding, but to be wise. And so what does wisdom look like when we hear these radical teachings of Jesus? It doesn't look like just sort of simple-mindedly following a new set of laws or codes that determine our exterior behavior. To really understand Jesus is to know that he's never given us, because of his discomfort and dissatisfaction with the way the law of Moses, that good and holy law that was given on the mountain, was distorted and became something that it wasn't intended to be, Jesus knows very well that he can run the risk of giving people a new set of laws that would end up in the same boat, missing the point. And so if you treat this like, now run and be good little Christians, loving your neighbor, or loving your enemies, doing good to those who hate you, you're missing the point. And the point is that Jesus wants you and I to come to terms with a radical encounter of the love of God. If you want to talk about radical, it's not me loving my enemy. It's me loving my enemy because I've been first loved by God. And that's where the radicality begins. We just become a bunch of, you know, wild-eyed, frizzy-haired wingnuts if we don't begin there in the love of God. Now, we still might be wild-eyed and a little crazy, but there's a redemptive quality to the person who's zealous because they're deeply in love. Right? The redemptive quality to that. You can tolerate that kind of zeal. The zealot who you feel actually hates you or is out to harm you, that's a very different feel. And so this, I think, is our invitation to think about what we're being called to, and in part to think about how the story of Joseph is a, for instance, at least for the church, and presumably in Jesus' mind, when he's saying these things, he's saying, you know, these greats in our, the hall of faith, fame, the hall of fame, faith, those faithful are in the hall of fame. In Hebrews chapter 11, Jesus too would have known of and would have had in mind when he tells us to do these things. So in Joseph's story, we get this enactment of this forgiveness that goes beyond the justice or the, you know. Joseph could have said, aha, right? The Lord has vindicated me. He's delivered these brothers into my hand. And there is maybe a bit of that in the story. If, depending on how you read it, you may recall the story. Joseph's brothers sell him because they're jealous of him. They sell him into slavery. That was a step down from just killing him in the story. And so they sell him into slavery. Joseph goes through some hard times there, but continually sort of rises above the circumstances and finally ends up being second in command, arguably the second most powerful and important person in the known world of the day, second only to Pharaoh in Egypt. And his brothers come because of famine to buy food. Joseph has all the cards. He knows who they are. They have no idea who he is. He knows what they're saying. They don't know when he talks or he's not. I mean, he knows. They think they're having private conversations. He can hear everything, understand everything they're saying. All of this is giving all the power to Joseph, and he chooses to use that power to enter into reconciliation and forgiveness. He wept on his brothers and kissed them. It's this lovely thing, right? Like this is, I mean, it's really quite a dramatic moment, isn't it? I'm Joseph. In case you forget who Joseph is, I'm the one you sold. As if they didn't know that, you know, like they're like, yeah, Joseph, and now what? Not a happy time for the brothers. But it ends up being this wonderful testimony of the purpose of God. I love what Von Rad says in his commentary on this passage, speaking about the purpose of the storyteller, the one who crafted Genesis and gives us this, whether that's God or Moses in your own mind or how you read that. He says, the narrator indicates clearly what is of paramount importance to him in the entire Joseph story. This is the reason the guy or the person gave us Joseph's story. This is the point he wanted to make, according to Von Rad. God's hand, which directs all the confusion of human guilt. I love that image. God's hand, which directs all the confusion of human guilt, ultimately toward a gracious goal. That's the point of the story. All of this stuff motivated by jealousy, by greed, by Joseph. He was a bit of a cocky guy, right? He was a you know, he sort of had it coming to him. Not that level, but you know what I mean. All of this, God's hand was in it. All of this, God's hand was in it. God's hand, which directs all the confusion of human guilt. directing it ultimately towards a gracious goal. It's just this lovely, lovely picture that we need to remember if we're to benefit from Jesus' teaching. When we make this about us and our ability to do something, to prove something, to be something, we're like, Jesus, thanks for the new list. That's great. Watch me go. That's fine when you're three, you know. Watch me go, that attitude. Like, how long, really? Maybe in 16 and 27 you can sustain that, but at some point you realize that's not going to work. That's not, you know, watch me go. Blah, face down, right? Face plant. How's that do, you know, how'd that go, God? Did you watch me? This gracious guiding of the confusion of human guilt towards this good goal. So, okay, well, first, when Jesus says love, he's not talking about, as Barclay reminds us, Jesus does not intend at all that we should feel towards our enemies the way we feel towards our family, our children, our spouse, our parents. We've almost exclusively associated love with a feeling that we can mistake part of what Jesus is saying. So I like the way Luke does it. He doesn't dwell on this love. He says, by love I mean this: bless, pray for, do good. Do you want to know what it looks like to love your enemy? Shovel their walk. Ask them if they need something from the grocery store when you're on your way. That's assuming you have some proximity and knowledge of your enemy. Do good to them. That's what loving means. So let's get rid of that kind of obstacle, that barrier, that sort of confusion of mind and spirit. Love your enemies. Maybe there are humans for whom they just overflow with goodness and gratitude to all humanity, and they actually feel like they love their neighbors. God bless them, and I'm great they're those kind of people, but God, Jesus is not asking me to do that. I can perhaps pray towards that. Jesus is saying, Oz, you know how to be nice to people. That's what I'm asking you to do, especially the person who's been not nice to you. The person you have a grudge, the person you have legitimate right to be offended or upset with, that's the person. Pray for them. Bless them. Go out of your way to say, I really hope you're having a good day today, Warren. See, I hate this guy, but you know. Just for illustration, not anything real there. Except for the blessing. How do you bless somebody? You can't bless somebody from a distance. You need to get into their world, their space a bit. You need to get dirty, if that's what that means, or get messy. Invite a bit of chaos into your well-ordered and sustained and controlled little world. That's what loving looks like. Jesus himself, of course, who is the love of God incarnate, occasionally has to tell people, you need to quit doing what you're doing. He had some very hard words occasionally. He didn't always turn the other cheek. Of course, he did on the cross for our sake. But there were times in which it would have been inappropriate for him to suffer without responding, as he does in the trial in John's Gospel, where the soldier smacks him and he says, you're being out of line. I did not do anything that would have let you smack me in that way. And he called them on it. He didn't just turn the other cheek. So there needs to be discernment in all this. But beneath all of this, and so we can get our thinking caps engaged. We can be wise about this, right? We can develop understanding about this. We can place this call to love in the context of who Jesus is and who he revealed God to be, and ultimately what it means to follow a crucified one, taking up our own cross daily. All of that needs to be important. But all of this becomes another way of just being better humans, pulling ourselves up with our own bootstraps unless it begins with the essential ingredient, which is to have first lost ourselves in the love of God. Joseph, the only way he could forgive is if he had had a deep and nurturing faith that he built his identity on. Otherwise, it was a consistent faith that kept him in slavery, kept him in being falsely accused and placed in prison, kept him being skipped over. His case did not become brought before Pharaoh when he thought it might as the wine taster. Yeah, the wine taster is reinstated to Pharaoh's service. All of these things were things that were disappointments in Joseph's life. He must have had a faith that nourished and sustained him there, because when he had the opportunity to reverse fortunes for himself, he did not choose it, but he remained consistent. And that's the kind of thing that I believe the gospel tries to remind us, that I believe the church for 2,000 years has all been all about this. The church does not say, now go out and be better people, go out and be better Christians, although it does say that. It says, follow Jesus. Jesus gives us these words, but Jesus knows that he has to say these words in such a way that we don't take the words as an end point, but as a beginning point. We don't take them as a final set of marching orders, but we take them as this encounter, this opportunity to engage, to be open. So many of us treat what Jesus said as a new set of laws, a new set of commands. And Jesus gives them as an invitation. He wants to say to us, do you know how deeply I love you? But for some reason, we can't hear that. And so he says, love your enemy. And we say, yes, Jesus, I'll show you how good I am at that. And then when we fall flat on our face, we have that second conversation with him. When we say, Jesus, how can I love my enemy? And he says, do you know how I love you? That's how you can love your enemy, is because I love you. And we still don't get it, so we fall again. We try something else. Well, maybe I can't love my enemies, but maybe I can give to the poor. Or whatever it is, we try very hard. Something in us is very afraid of just letting ourselves go and losing ourselves in the love of God. And that's the only place to begin. There's no beginning apart from knowing how greatly we're loved by God. No beginning. Not as Christians. So when we lose ourselves in the love of God, we find ourselves in the love of God. And then we just go out. Because we've been so greatly forgiven, we forgive others. Because we've received mercy, we give mercy. Because we haven't been condemned, we release others. But how do you get there? Jesus was had the same difficulty I have. How do you say a word and do something that words can't do, right? So then we look at the life of Jesus and we lose ourselves as we begin to hear anew and again, I love you. The cross, I love you. Baptism, I love you. The Eucharist, I love you. Come, lose yourself in my love, and then go out and be God's children as you love others, all others. Thank you, Jesus. Amen.